What car has the worst cooling that you have a solution for?
The Honda Type R, the FK8, had terrible cooling. Radiator was sucked. It just wasn't good. And then guys would put a huge, you know, aftermarket intercooler in front of it. That makes the cooling even worse. We worked with HPD, like on an oil cooler solution. So they were adding those to all the, you know, TCR cars. So from factory, you were getting a CSF cooling package in there. You were getting a radiator and you're getting an oil cooler kit that they were adding in the car. So that was a cool program to work on. Nissan 370Z, terrible cooling system in that car. It's actually a radiator and a condenser module in one. So, you know, it's like all stacked together. It's a pretty interesting way they made it, but I think it's over-engineered, to be honest. And I don't think they really gave it all the real-world testing. And then they definitely didn't take into account adding more power to the car, and it just doesn't have the headroom to support, you know, the tuning and like the aftermarket. So what we did is we actually separated it. We made it a separate radiator and a separate condenser, but we bolted together. So we were able to put a bigger radiator into the application and still make it fit without having to modify anything.
Our special guest today, Ravi Dalwani, owner and founder of the Racing and Performance Division of CSF. Eat Sleep Race Podcast, our special guest today, Ravi Dalwani, owner and founder of the Racing and Performance Division of CSF. Did I say that correctly?
Yep, nailed it.
And my co-host here and partner, Hugo ESR.
What's going on, guys?
Let's get into a little bit of the history. I know CSF Radiators has been around since the 40s, but you created a performance division of CSF. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, basically in 2009, when I had graduated from college, you know, my father had been in the business, so he was third generation. I'm fourth generation, and he's doing OEM replacement cooling. And, you know, I grew up a Honda kid, you know, Fast and Furious era was when I was in high school. And I saw what he was doing, and I kind of said, okay, well, this is a family business. I like what he does, but I'm super passionate about, like, motorsports and, you know, high performance. I said, is there a way I can merge those two things? So that's kind of where, you know, he helped me out a little bit, got to start doing a high-performance cooling brand. You know, obviously it takes a few years to figure it out, but you know, now we're here 15 years later.
So what made you, well, one, since it's a family business, out of high school, was it even an option, like just jump straight into the family business?
You know, I think back then, like people really valued like, you know, hey, go to college, get a degree, get an education. You know, I went to school for engineering.
Oh, wow.
That lasted about a semester because I was partying too hard. So, you know, I switched to economics. And, you know, I actually think that was probably one of the best decisions I could have ever made.
Why do you say that?
Well, because, you know, it's a global company. You're dealing with different currencies, you know, just from like a macroeconomic level about buying raw material, you know, pricing things appropriately, you know, distribution channels and margin structures and all those things. I mean, you use economics almost every day of your life, right? No matter what you're doing.
That.
Exactly. You know, and like engineering, you need to have like a basic understanding of engineering, but a lot of that stuff is like kind of learn on the job, right? Yeah. And if you're like hyper-focused and like, hey, I'm going to be in the cooling business, you just need to know everything about cooling. You don't have to go to school for that, right? You can learn it from anybody, right? So that's kind of where I thought, you know, economics was a good trade-off for me.
When you originally said that you wanted to do the performance side of thing, you mentioned that your dad was third generation. Was there some sort of like, well, we need somebody to still run the regular side of the business?
Not really. You know, I think his idea, and I think his dad did it with him, it was like everyone's kind of find their own way, and it's better to like add on and stack to what CSF is all about. You know, if you can go and pave the way and do something different, but it's still kind of core competency of cooling, then, you know, why don't you go give it a shot?
So what was your first project for the performance side?
You know, he actually tried to do a performance division kind of and tack on to like that whole Fast and Furious craze. And he was making aluminum radiators. It was like cheesy marketing. You know, they weren't even real like pictures of cars. It was like a stock race car with like a CSF graphic put on it. So I tried to start selling all his old inventory that he couldn't really move. But yeah, it was a lot of Honda stuff, you know, Honda, Nissan, you know, that whole import craze that was coming off that Fast and Furious wave. And then when I started to develop products, you know, I kind of really got some recognition in the market by making stuff that hadn't been developed by anybody else. So that was really where we kind of tacked on to like the Porsche stuff, the BMW. I was the first one in the world with a 370Z cooling solution because those cars were overheating like crazy. So it was really about finding vehicles at the time that were either going into limp mode or really needed cooling upgrades. And that's kind of how we got the name out. And that took a few years to kind of, you know, figure out what was going to work and what was going to stick.
With those products like that you were like pinpointing the weak links of certain platforms, was that hard to find for you? Or, you know, just being in the motorsports, you know,
people must have been complaining to you like through the grapevine.
I need a radiator for this. Right. I need a radiator for that.
Yeah. And, you know, once you go, you put the word out there, like, this is what we do. And, you know, we really rely on the dealer network and like the ecosystem of Southern California,
right? To announce their needs.
Like what they're seeing.
Exactly. You know, we got the tracks out there. All the shops are out there. You know, we're very fortunate that we're a Southern California company. And, you know, you start to develop these relationships with these dealers, these racers. And, you know, you start to hear like, hey, man, I took my, you know, Porsche 987 Cayman out to the track and, you know, it's Button Willow and it's the middle of summer. It's 100 degrees outside. I can only do 2 laps. You know, and, you know, these guys are going to the track and they're spending all this money to get there on a day. And, you know, if you can't maximize the enjoyment, then, you know, then what are you doing? So that's really where we kind of said, okay, how do we extend the guys' time on the track so where they can really get the best bang for their track day?
Are you personally engineering everything or do you have a team of engineers at CSF?
For the longest time, it was just me. So, and then I realized I was becoming the bottleneck to my own company, right? When you're kind of wearing many hats, just like you guys do, and, you know, one day you think you're going to sit down and do a bunch of engineering work and 50 things get thrown at you before it's even 8 a.m. Yeah. So now we have a full-time engineer. He's been with me for about 2 years, nice. And him and I work kind of side and side. His name's David. He's great. And, you know, he's a younger kid. I'm trying to be a mentor to him and trying to show him the business aspect of it too, right? I've always told him, like, hey, the best type of engineer is a sales engineer. If you can talk the talk and, you know, do the walk and you walk in and be confident about what you can do really well in this business. And that's kind of what I am, right? It's like I can do the selling, I can engineer it, I can come up with a concept and, you know, put it all together for customers.
And it's kind of like difference in personalities too, because thankfully for you, you're a jack of all trades, but I also see it in different ways. Like engineers are kind of like, what do you call that? When they keep to themselves.
Introverted.
There you go.
Yeah, introverted and timid. And he's a little like that. And I'm trying to get him out of his shell because he's a very good person, you know, and he's got a good personality. But yeah, I mean, engineers inherently just want to be by themselves, sit at a desk and, you know, just
solve problems.
And solve problems. And, you know, that's why I think it's a very good skill. And it's very needed in the engineering field is guys who can be personable, have a beer with you, but can also talk shop and design what you need.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's like once you have that skill, you increase your self-value there, just like you have.
Yeah, and, you know, I always tell people, it's like, you know, the part is just an item. People do business with people, right? So you want to be able to be somebody that people want to be around and interact with because then they find ways to do more business with you.
That's right.
So if the product is good, that's great, but the people around it is really what makes the brand.
Yeah.
I think that's the importance of shows like this as well. I mean, your energy attracts similar energy. So if you're coming out here, you're a good person, you're attracting good people. And that's been one of our biggest reasons why we personally keep coming back to the show since we started, what, 5-6 years ago?
We started in 16.
Like a lot of the relationships that we have today came off of this show because we came up in the import racing scene. So like all of our networks and connections were strictly that because all of the events that we went to were only import events. And now all the other realms of racing that we've dived into in the past 6 years have happened at this show. And now the podcast is such a great platform because we get to learn way more than we would just shaking hands at the booth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, long form podcast and, you know, having that time to really kind of dive deep, ask people personable questions, you know, in a more relaxed environment. It's the way media is going, right?
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know, you originally said you were a Honda guy. Was that in college, in high school?
It was in high school. It was kind of like a hand-me-down car from one of my dad's like friend's kid.
Before Fast and Furious?
You know, I got my license in, let's say, 2003.
So I feel around
like,
that era.
Yeah, right around that era.
So you saw the black Civics with the green underlight kits?
Absolutely. That was me, man. I had like a V6 Accord, you know, with like the triangle taillights in the back.
Absolutely.
And bought an eBay underglow kit.
Did you really?
I had the Alpine flip-up screen. I mean, you know, we were fortunate. We had Auto Shop back then. So in high school, we had Auto Shop.
So you were able to tinker with your own stuff.
Yeah, you know, so you could tinker on your own car and, you know, you could do the class multiple semesters and get repeat credit. That's what I did. And, you know, I had a good friend. His name was Blake. And, you know, he was into tinkering with his car. We modified a golf cart. You know, he had a BMW that we did a bunch of stupid shit to. And, you know, just having a good time. So that's kind of how you learn, you know, wrenching on cars. And, yeah, it was awesome.
From a Fast and Furious era car to now one of the most well-built resto mod Porsche 911s in the history.
Thank you.
That's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of, you know, you learn a lot in this industry, and I love building cars. You know, it's a huge passion of mine. I want to do more of it. You know, I'm gearing up for the next car. You know,
hey, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
Don't get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I love just learning the process, the journey, the build, and it's really about the people you interact with. Mm-hmm. You know, every car that I've built or put together, you know, there's a whole mix of people who are specialists in that platform, and you get to know them and you bring in new people. And, you know, obviously you have your favorites, like, you know, Rywire is always going to be wiring my cars, right? He's one of my best friends and he's the best at what he does and he's a mainstay. But, you know, if you're doing something Porsche, you got to tap into that Porsche culture and you got to figure out who's the who. And then, you know, whether it's a BMW, go somewhere else. So yeah,
it's actually like to go back on that. So the Porsche, you actually listed it for sale as one of those, I don't want to sell it, but if somebody wants it for this price tag, what was that price tag?
I listed it at $899,000, so $900,000.
So we're going Fast and Furious era of having this hand-me-down Honda Accord, probably like $500-$600. And how many years later when you finished the Porsche completely?
So we finished the car in 21. We took it to SEMA. So, you know, it was kind of miraculous. It was a COVID car, really, you know, but... I didn't have any kids back then. A lot of people were just sitting at home. A lot of people were kind of bored. So a lot of people, like good people, had the time and jumped on it to help us put that car together. And I think that's why it's so special. Like, I think if I said to all those same partners on the bill, like, hey, I'm going to do this now, it wouldn't get done. Yeah. Not in that timeline because everyone's busy.
It's too busy.
Yeah, and everyone's got their own life back and, you know, things are moving in a different pace. Right. So, yeah, I think it was like lightning in a bottle. It was just the right time for that car to be built. And honestly, I don't think that car can ever be replicated.
What inspired the interior?
You know, I needed...
A lot of people, not to cut you off, but a lot of people, they always do like custom interior, little different patterns and stuff like that. And yeah, you definitely, it kind of reminded me like back in the day, right? Like everybody had like Gucci seats stuff like that. So when you brought it back, it's like you did something like that was cool back in, I would say like mid-2000s. Yeah, but you took it to a next level.
Don't disrespect Ravi with the Gucci and let everyone know who's watching this. He has Goyard.
Yeah. I was waiting for him to say that.
I mean, we're talking from, cool, that's luxurious, to Goyard. Like, that's not...
That's like extreme luxury.
I don't even know what you call that. It's just like extreme luxury.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think... And exactly what you said, Hugo, is a lot of people who do Porsches, you know, they kind of go back to the tried and true, right? Oh, it's tartan interior or Pepita or, you know, Pasha print, right? And... I wanted to find something that really elevated the car to like a GT level, you know? So it's a nice mix of like the performance from like a race car, but it's a street car. And I wanted it to be when you sat inside, you're like, okay, this is luxury.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little mix of everything, but I wanted it not to be like so like standout-ish and like, oh my God, he put like Louis Vuitton seats or a bunch of LVs or Gucci. And Goyard's one of those things. It's like, if you know, you know, it's a pattern in itself. And that's what I liked about it is that, it's, you know, if you didn't know what it was, you'd be like, oh, cool pattern.
Yeah, you're not even paying attention to it.
Yeah, so it's like almost like understated luxury unless you're kind of into fashion. And it's also canvas, not leather. So it was going to wear well. You know, it's going to have a patina over the lifetime of the car. And, you know, I just felt like that was going to be one of those things that really took the car to a next level. Like, it's a wow factor. It's a talking point. And to execute it, it's extremely difficult. So I had the right guy who's like, yo, I can line it all up perfectly. And, you know, it was almost like one of those beautiful minds. Like, he wrote it on a wall and said, okay, this is how we're going to lay it out. It's exactly perfect, diagonally, horizontally, and vertically. Like, it looks like it came from a factory like that.
And how'd you get the material?
We had to buy the bags. And that was like a challenge on its own. It's a story of itself because, you know, Goyard's one of those things that you cannot buy online.
Right.
You have to go to a boutique, and there's only six of them in the U.S. Fortunately, there's one in Beverly Hills, so it's only about like an hour and a half from our house. And it's kind of like a game, you know, like you walk in and you're like, hey, I want to buy six of this like burgundy bags. They're going to be like, you sound like a reseller.
Right.
You know, they're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my build partner, his wife is Asian. She walked in. They had no problem selling it to her.
Yep.
You know, like,
that's
oh,
how it
cool.
works.
Crazy yeah, they're like, changes. Hey, man, rich Chinese lady, dude. You know, yeah, you can tell her whatever we want, you know? So it took like three trips to get all those bags.
Okay.
Yeah, because I obviously didn't have all of those in stock, and you have to reorder them.
Order it, wait.
We actually were running out of material. You know, there was a lot of scrap because to line it up perfectly, there was a lot of the sides that you couldn't use because we didn't want to like stitch like random panels. We wanted it all to be like a full panel. There was like only one section of the bag that will literally go in that
cover
section.
That piece,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. So I have a lot of like knickknack stuff with Goyard stuff on it. I made my kid a diaper bag. I got Nike shoes. You know, like I got a lot of like cool Goyard stuff.
For those unfamiliar with Goyard, like how much is a bag?
You know, we got like the large tote bags because that was like your best bang for your buck, and it like it's kind of malleable. Like it's not a lot of structure to it. I think each one of those now is about $1,200, and we started with six, and then we ended up with eight.
Wow.
So, you know, it's over 10K in bags.
Just in fabric.
Yeah.
Material.
But, you know, a lot of people are like, wow, that's crazy. But if you look at the total cost of the
build is going to.
It actually is justifiable,
right?
Yeah,
right. So, actually, we learned from Ryan, your throttle bodies alone, what was that, like 20 grand or something?
Yeah, man, that's Kinsler stuff. And, you know, they're here at the PRI show. And, you know, like you said, it's a great place to make connections. And they've been very good to us. It is the best of the best. And, you know, leaning on Ryan, who, you know, he's the wiring guy. He does all the injection stuff. He knows a lot of it. I mean, he's like, hey, these are like three or four brands that make really good, you know, throttle body setups for 911s. But if you want the best, he goes, no doubt it's Kinsler drive-by-wire. And it really is next level. And now my builder is using that exclusively on all his builds. You know, I walked by the Kelly Moss booth earlier. They have it on their stuff. So, yeah, definitely Kinsler is the way to go.
So you spared no expense on this build. You know, you said at one point it was your Picasso. We're going to get a little ahead of ourselves here. The car is for sale.
But it's not on sale.
Correct.
Yeah, I like that, Hugo. Exactly.
Right. What's next for the stable of CSF?
You know, the Porsche market is something, I mean, you guys know it. There's a ton of resto mod companies, right? It starts with like Singer and it kind of trickles down. And when I built that car, I never built it with the idea that I was going to replicate it or sell these. So it truly is a one-off with all like the metalwork and like kind of that build. But the next thing I want to do is actually start a resto mod Ferrari company. And I'm going into it with the intention that I would sell these cars. So I kind of want to do like 90s era Ferraris. Like really I'm kind of honing in on like a 355 because I think it's a timeless looking car. Yep. And I think there's so many things about the car that if you just made it better, it would be amazing, you know, a little bit more power, drive-by-wire, you know, a little wider,
update
it, kind of give it that OEM plus look that I enjoy building cars to. So that's really what I want to do. And not along with that is, you know, you look at Ferrari, it's almost becoming an asset class in itself, right? And people will pay anything to keep these cars on the road. So not only will I want to build the whole car, we want to have an engine program.
Yeah, so, be able to support it.
Yeah, support the car. So, you know, even if you don't want the whole car, but you want to get your engine rebuilt or you need the parts for it, we want to develop that whole program. And also any of the parts that we make for the specific car will be available for sale. You know, like Porsche, the why there's so many of these resto mod companies is because Porsche Classic exists. Mm-hmm. They are supporting these classic cars staying on the road.
Yep.
But really a lot of these other brands don't have that.
No.
So I really want to become like Ferrari Classic. Right, and develop these parts and then take them to market, stock them in my warehouse, and really be able to use all the knowledge that I have from owning a company that does distribution to be able to do that and offer these parts, and you can buy them from anywhere in the world.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
So the biggest takeaway I'm getting from this is going to the business side of things. You're an entrepreneur at heart, right? So it's already like people will look at you like, dude, you already have CSF. The parent company is massive. The performance company is booming. You're thinking about doing a multi-million dollar Ferrari company. Like that just shows your personality in general. Like I'm sure
always thinking forward.
You probably even have other businesses that we didn't even touch upon yet that you're involved in.
Yeah, you know, I live and breathe CSF. You know, I'm hyper focused on it, but I have all these other passions and like I love what I do. But I was thinking about this like after I built that Porsche, I was like, man, am I going to be like 6 years old selling BMW radiators? Like, is there anything else out there for me that like, could be a challenge and I can kind of tack on and like be, let that be part of my legacy, you know? So that's why I was like, and I love deals, man. I love chasing it. I love business. You know, I love pushing myself. I love the people that you get to meet, the places you get to go. And I just think that's something that is calling for me to do. And, you know, I want to give it a shot.
That's cool, man. Looking forward to seeing the light of day of that whole idea come to fruition. I don't even doubt if, you're probably not even gonna have to sell the Porsche. Itch in you is just gonna make the Ferrari thing happen sooner than later.
Exactly. I don't want to sell the Porsche. My wife was like, "Hey, man, this is something super unique. Like, you're gonna hate it if you sell this." And I'm like, "Oh, you're probably right." But The money would be nice. You know, I think the capital investment to do this Ferrari thing right is like, to do it like exceptional at the same level of going to Pebble Beach and Goodwood and like really laying it out there at a high level, I think I need about $3 million. I don't want to just build one car. I want to build two at the same time because I want to give people the concept of like, hey, you can get it from A to Z. You know, one of them might be a Berlenta, one of them might be a Spider, one might be more race, one might be more like coach and elegance like GT and tell people like, hey, what do you really want, right? If they only see one car, I think that's it. But if they see two different cars, now they're my imagination starts to move and they start saying, okay, maybe this is what I want for mine. So I think it's the right time. I really think right now we are literally in the golden era of, you know, car modification. People our generation, you know, they're looking back and saying the car that I would really want is something from like the early 2000s or like the 90s, because that's what we grew up and that's kind of what you want to make better, right? And I think now with the way technology is and the stuff you see at these shows, it's like you walk by these booths and these companies you've never heard of and they're making like amazing product, right? And you can literally say like, damn, this is going to be big, right? I want to bring in a lot of these like newer brands and kind of just push the limits on what a vehicle can be,
right?
And especially obviously you have such a great network that you've built in, you know, recent years. I don't see any doubt that this is going to come to the light of day very soon. So we got a little bit ahead of ourselves going straight into the cars. I actually have one more question relevant to that. You mentioned the Honda Accord that you started with. Now you have this, you know, very expensive concourse, if not this car belongs in a museum, Porsche. Do you have anything in between in your stable?
Yeah, I mean, I actually still have I have a DC5 RSX. I daily it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's got a 300 horsepower NA motor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Daily.
I'm basically dailying a race car on the freeway every day in LA. So that's awesome. You know, it's a hatchback. I stop at the powder coater. I throw a bunch of parts in the back, you know. I've repainted the car. I've done a bunch of stuff. So that's an awesome build. And
still a Honda guy.
Yeah, still a Honda guy, man. And my wife goes, why do you still have this car? Like, you look like an idiot, you know? I'm like, no, you don't get it, babe, you know? Yeah, if you're a Honda guy, you'll always be a Honda guy. I have a new RS6. You know, so that's pretty cool. It's you know, it's got bronze wheels, it's green, tan interior. So I really like that. And I have an M5. I got a 2015 M5, so a little bit more like, you know, analog BMW sedan. Mm-hmm. I have a 996 turbo that's a paint to sample. So I got a few cars. I got the Evo race car still, that we, you know, campaign in Global Time Attack, and you know, we have a professional driver for that. So yeah, that's kind of what my stable is right now.
That's cool. And just let it be known, this Porsche, even though I did mention it should be in a museum, if not always on a concourse, can also be for sale at, you know, on Beverly Hills, Rodeo Drive. It's been on the track, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I drive it a lot. I've taken it on a rally. You know, I went through like Idaho and Oregon with it.
Put miles to that car.
Yeah, you know, it put miles on it. I mean, it was shipped to Europe this past summer. Famous guy drove it on the Nürburgring. You know, like, this thing is a real deal, and it's got the beauty marks to show for it. You know, it's got rock chips, and I think the first time I drove the car I got a rock chip, and it's like after that you're like, oh fuck, car's ruined, you know, like might as well drive it. So I took it to the track for a magazine shoot, so we were at Fontana Speedway. So yeah, you know, it's definitely got the miles on it, man, and I drive it like I stole it, dude. I mean, there's no other way to do it.
Now with you, with CSF, you're always, it almost seems like you don't miss a beat, especially when it comes to the product development, new models, new variations. Are you able to get access to some of these cars early or just certain parts? Or do you just share, like, do you purchase cars for development, or you just work with different shops?
You know, because we're in Southern California, you know, this is like where it all starts. And we're very fortunate that we have such a good relationship with so many different dealers and so many different like segments that we can really reach out to them and we can get our hands on these cars quick. You know, whether it's a new Lamborghini Rovelto, you know, Bowden's got the first one. He let me take it apart, you know, take the OE parts out and, you know, get going on it. So we try to be first to market. We try to use our contacts. If I can avoid buying cars to just do product development, I always try to lean on, you know, what's the most efficient, cost-effective way of doing it. And so that's what we try to do, right? You know, sometimes we have a little bit more of a challenge of, you know, because CSF is a global brand, like, you know, we want to make Toyota Yaris parts. Well, those cars aren't here, you know, but they're in Mexico. So we got guys coming up from Mexico with cars and doing product development, or, you know, now thankfully with like 3D scanning, there's a lot of ways that you can pass files and forth.
Right.
So especially now that I got, you know, more engineering support, we can spend a little bit more time to, you know, kind of figure out how to put the puzzle together.
That's awesome.
Why CSF versus your competitors?
I feel like we really are the full package, from the engineering, the quality, the customer support, the branding, the association to the brand, the people who use it, you know, the testimonial that we can put from the guys who are racing it, guys who are using it. I mean, we live this, you know, and it starts with me. It starts with Alan, who's my general manager. Like, we are true enthusiasts. So we are not some corporate private equity company that's making coolers. Like, we are a cooling brand. We've been doing it for, you know, since the 40s. I think there's so much passion in what we do, and it really is genuine, right? And I think the market sees it, and I think that is like the sell, right? Like, when you buy this product, you're buying like our love for cooling, you know? And that's really what I think is the difference, right? Like, you buy our stuff, you know that the owner like
supports it,
you know? Like, yeah. Anybody can get a hold of me. Sometimes it's annoying, right? Like, I got random people calling me. I'm like, fuck, dude, how'd you get my number? You know, but I'll talk to them. Yeah. You know, you got an issue, we'll
you
take
spend
care
the time,
of it.
Yeah.
You know, you're we stand behind events. What we have. Like, not everything's perfect, you know? Mm-hmm. So if there's an issue, and especially at the level of motorsports that we're at now with like the B58, S58 platform, I mean,
yeah,
people are doing crazy stuff,
off.
Right? Like 1500 horsepower, like the car that we have in our booth,
mm-hmm.
you know, like something might break, but we're going to be there to support it. And we're going to figure out what broke, how it broke, and how we can make it better.
So actually, I saw on your Instagram, you had quite the challenge getting this your display car here. That actually gives a good question here. What's the biggest challenge you've had owning a business? He's like, this BMW.
No, I think the biggest challenge of owning a business is employees. Because I'm not just taking care of my family, I'm taking care of 30 people's families, you know? And we got to like understand that, yeah, when you walk into work, we want you to be hyper-focused and, you know, come to work and be ready to do what your job is. But everyone's carrying their personal problems around, right? And I got to be sensitive to the fact that... how to manage that. You know, like, people might have health issues or their family has health issues. And like, how do you be a compassionate owner? Because I'm also going through stuff. You know what I'm saying? So like, people got to be able to like... put it aside and be like, okay, how do I run my business and how do I deal with these challenges? Like, maybe this person's got to be gone for 3 or 4 weeks. Who can pick up the slack, right? Mm-hmm. Or, man, maybe this guy is hungover and he ain't coming on Monday, but he's good at what he does. How do you motivate him to change his lifestyle to be able to
be
a better person, you know, not just professionally, but personally, right? Or maybe people are going through substance abuse problems, or they're going through a divorce, or like, there's so many things that are happening with people's lives. And it's like, how do you manage that, right? Obviously, during COVID, you know, the supply chain issues and like logistics, like the manufacturing component to it, you know, and things are always changing in the world, whether it's going to be tariffs or there's wars in certain countries, or, you know, you can't get space on a container. So there's a million things that are happening. And I think for like my business, I'm where all the biggest problems come to me, right? The ones that people don't have an answer for, they land on my desk. So sometimes being a business owner, that's a challenge. Like, everybody else is doing something they enjoy, and all the non-fun stuff that people never talk about are on my desk, right? So I would say those are a couple of the things that, you know, are the challenges that you face every day. So
I like that you brought that up, the challenge with employees. Like, is that something you learn how to resolve formally, or are you just right off the gate, like, you already knew how to deal with it? Did you take classes for it? Like,
no, I think it's all experience. And I've made a lot of mistakes with employees. I've lost in employees because of the way I've dealt with it, right? I'm not a perfect boss. I can actually be kind of an asshole, you know? And sometimes I take that home and I see how it affects my family. And it's like, you always want to figure out how can you be a better person tomorrow, you know? And it starts today.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's just realizing what mistakes you've made, and kind of, as you get older, you kind of understand a little bit more. And as you get kids, you start to be a little bit more compassionate and understand what other people are going through,
right?
You know? So I just think it's just live and learn, right? You have to just understand, like, okay, well, I made that mistake last time. Let's not make it again.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that was one of my questions for you. I was like, you know, knowing you from before you had a kid to now that you are a dad, like, that definitely changed. Like, I could see that your persona changed a little bit. You're more... like, not softer, but you, like you said, you see the differences.
Empathetic.
Yeah. You know
empathetic,
what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
You see that because, like you said, someone dealing with that, you don't go through that experience. And then now, all of a sudden, you're like, man, this kid was crying all night. I see why he couldn't, like, he's late or whatever the reason may be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, once you have a kid, everything changes. Like, now it's all for him, you know? And I also understand, like, how much work my wife puts into it. Right? Like, she's at home with the kid and she's raising the family. I mean, it's not an easy job. Like, sometimes I'm at home with him and I'm like, man, I can't wait to go back to work.
I don't know how you do it.
You know, he's 2 and a half. He's running around like crazy. I mean, the amount of energy that he has, he's a great kid. And But you got to put time into it, right? And all my employees who have kids and growing families, they're dealing with the same thing. Like, yep. I understand why they come into work tired, you know, right. Or I understand why they came in late, you know.
And you didn't really see that 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, unless you...
You're only 2 years into being a dad, right?
Yeah, he's like 2.5 now, you know. And unless you're living it,
Certain experiences.
Yeah,
you
my kid was up all night. I'm like, okay, whatever, dude. Like, can't be that bad, right? But then when you deliver it, you're like, okay, I get exactly what he's going through, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, it's just a part of growing up and trying to, like I said,
manage everything.
Manage it all.
So you went to college, then you started the business. How many years are you in total in the business?
We just had our 15th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So, and to be honest, like, I almost stopped doing it after year four. Like, it just wasn't going anywhere. You know, I didn't realize.
What do you mean?
I think it was a big slice of humble pie because, like, you know, my dad has a very successful business and he's in the cooling. You know, he's been doing cooling for a long time. I thought walking into places.
Piggyback off that.
Yeah, and saying, hey, I'm from CSF. You know, we have a high performance division. Like, it'd be like, oh, cool. Yeah, we know what CSF is. And most people had no idea who CSF was because it's just a completely different industry, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're doing high performance race stuff. Like, why would you need to know what the OEM replacement brand is?
Right.
You know? So it was almost like starting again from zero. And just understanding, like, the level and the quality that the product had to be built to just get your foot in the door, you know? A lot of people were like, you know, I'd walk in, I'm like, oh, I'm a cooling brand. I'm like, oh, we're cool, dude. We got Koyo. We got Mishimoto. Like, we don't need another one, right? Like, where do you fit in? And why do we need to change what's working for us already? And, you know, that was kind of where, you know, I was trying to get dealers. And, you know, I used to sell parts on eBay. I mean, that's how I was just trying to get by, you know, with this brand. And then it was trying to find some dealers. Thankfully, there's a few people in Southern California who jumped on. A couple of Formula Drift guys started using the stuff. But we couldn't get any distributors for a while. You know, until you can get into distribution and start moving, like, significant volume, you're losing money, you know? Yeah, you can sell 20, 30, 40 parts a month, but, like, that ain't it.
That ain't,
you know, you need
it.
People to be buying pallets. And, like, that's kind of what the business is based off. So, I remember just, you know, my dad helped me go to the SEMA show a couple times and, you know, he kicked the bill for it and whatever money I was making was literally getting dropped back into, you know, marketing and investing into the brand. I remember that just year four at SEMA, I was like, dude, if I don't get a distributor this year, like, this might be it.
This is right.
You know, and I just remember being at the booth and I'm like, fuck, dude, like, the guys that I try to schedule meetings with, they're not coming. And, like, yeah, so it was a little disheartening and I was like, maybe I can't do this, you know, maybe. But, you know, between year four and five, it finally clicked.
So what was that turning point from I'm about to give up to all right, now we got something?
I really think people's greatness happens when they're about to give up. If you can just push a little bit more through that ceiling, like, that's where things will kind of, like, check off, right? And I remember that year, Michael Esso won Formula Drift.
Okay.
He was using our cooling systems. That got a lot of notoriety because...
That was in a BMW, right?
Yeah.
E46?
Yeah, exactly. He was driving a BMW E46, and I remember, like, he was at Texas against Chris Forsberg, and it was super hot, and Chris was sponsored by Mishimoto, and he kept on having to call timeout because his car was overheating, and Mike would just zoom back up to the line, and they did, like, 3 or 4 one more times.
Yeah.
And Mike was just ready, you know, and he really shouted out CSF, you know, and really kind of said, hey, you know, these are the coolers that I'm using. Ron Bergenholtz was another person who gave me a chance, you know, on the full tilt Mazda RX-8 that he built for, you know, back in the day. You know, there was a couple Global Time Attack guys who started using our Porsche stuff. You know, they were out in the summertime tracking their car the whole session. GMG, which is a huge Porsche shop out in Los Angeles, they helped me and they started putting all of our coolers on their cars. So, you know, the word just started to get out. And finally, I had a couple small WDs, you know, like regional guys start taking the line on, and it kind of grew. And then, you know, the Motovicities, the Turn 14s, you know, like the Premieres, like these guys started to jump on the brand. And, you know, I would say, like, that year 4 or 5 is really when things started to take off.
That's like that meme that you always see where the guy's, like, digging for gold.
Yep.
And he's, like, about to give up. And then you see, like, the big, all the nuggets are over there. Like, that's, like, kind of like the similar situation
when you push through, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be here talking to you guys if I decided to, like, you know, just
throw it
out. I'll just go do what my dad's doing.
You'd be at Apex.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be at Apex, right? So, yeah. So, and I try to mentor, like, the younger generation. You know, like, I'm in my late 30s now. I'm 37. And, you know, I see a lot of guys coming up and they're, like, 23 or 25 or, you know, late 20s, and they have a brand and, you know, they, oh, we want to go to the SEMA show. And I tell them, I'm like, hey, listen, like, you need to have a 5-year plan. You can't just go to SEMA 1 year and think you're going to light the world on fire, you know? And, like, I see a lot of these guys, they're, like, kind of dejected. And they're like, oh, I went to SEMA, man. Nothing really happened for me. I feel like I just spent a lot of money. And I'm like,
well, I'll tell you where they first messed up. They should have came to PRI first.
Yeah, I should have came. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think the show is a great place for people to kind of use it as a launch point. It's way more cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
People who are here are not getting distracted by like the glitz of Vegas and the gambling and the partying and all that stuff.
Hyper targeted.
Like, exactly. Like if you come to Indiana in the middle of the winter, you're here to do business, right? And
you're in the industry.
You're in the industry. So I think that this is a great place for people to get a start. I always recommend people before you jump in to go to a trade show, walk the show 1 year,
Know,
cause then you understand like, where's my booth going to be?
Yeah.
You know, typically, you know, the rookies get put in a place that's not so attractive. So you have to understand who's your rep at PRI or at SEMA and kind of like finagle and be like, hey, I've walked the show. Maybe this isn't the right place for me. Like I'm in a very unique spot. I'm in the hallway.
Right.
But that's the best part of that hallway where you're right next to the PRI merchandise store. Like I walked the show. And when they said, this is what we're going to give you, I said, okay, I'll take it. I don't want to be
there
in
for
one
how
of these,
many years now?
I've been there for 8 years. So this is our eighth year at PRI. And they're always like, hey, dude, you know, you have enough seniority. Do you want to move into the hall? And I'm like, people kind of know that we're here now, you know?
Oh, that's your spot
now. That's our spot. So it is
different. We did the opposite. We were in the hallway where no one cared
about
us.
We were in a room
first.
When we started.
Exactly what you said. We went through the ranks. We had no in. So we started out in the corner room where nobody came in and we were still happy when we left.
Same
thing, because whoever did come by, they
we would have never met them.
It's
still an opportunity.
It's still a worthy opportunity. So anyone inspiring, if SEMA's on your to-do list, highly recommend. I've been an ambassador for the show since my first year here because we had such a good time. Anyone starting a business or currently have a business, that's actually a shame that I think of it when I know a lot of people in the industry and they've never even come to the show.
Yeah. Like, I push it.
I push it a lot too.
And you just come walk it, like you said.
I tell people, it's like, if you've never been to PRI, you got to go.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll give you a perfect example. That car that's in our booth, that M2 is from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
The two kids who built that are 26 and like 23.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they're super inspiring. You know, they're go-getters or hustlers, and they're doing stuff that I wish I could do when I was that young, man. Mm-hmm. I was still trying to figure it out, you know? And
same.
Last year, we had their G80 Touring in the booth at SEMA, and they wanted to build this car and say, hey, we want to take it to SEMA. I said, listen, man, if you're building a race car, like you got to try something different, bring it to PRI.
Right.
It is a totally different vibe. It is more motorsports oriented. And I'm really glad they trusted me and, you know, the car made it.
Yeah.
So is the car, they've shipped it over here literally just for the show?
It's going to be here for like pretty much the whole 2025 season. So we're going to take it to Texas 2K and FL 2K. Maybe actually do take it to SEMA. I want to enter those guys into the young gun category because I think that build is worth it. You know, being at that level at the Battle of the Builders and making it to the top 10 myself, I kind of understand like at what level these cars need to be built at. And that is a very, very well built race car.
They did not cut
any corners. So yeah, we definitely want to use it to campaign and really kind of show like the motorsports orientation of what we do, but also what they can do. Right. That's and all the partners that are on that car is, it's a good list of partners.
We always talk to like, especially recently, like the era that we grew up in, right. Our cars were, horsepower wise, power levels were maybe 200, like 200 horsepower is a lot of horsepower back then. And then now you're getting into a stock BMW or these Supras that are, you know, already almost double that with a little bit of help, a little bit of accessories and stuff, you're making like 600-700 horsepower. Do you see that big jump like as a benefit or kind of like a,
like because these cars already
because
have
these cars
the
are so fast now,
or,
it's like do you see what am I looking for? A negative side where like these kids can't even handle the horsepower.
Yeah, I mean that there's something to that, right? I mean, from a business side, it helps because the more power you put in it, the more heat you're generating, and you need to cool it down. So there's obviously now more of a need for the cooling components that we manufacture. I definitely think there's a lot of people who can't handle the power. I mean, even like, you know, my buddy, he's got a Ferrari F8. First time he took it out, he spun out. You know, he wasn't ready for it. You know what I'm saying? Like, he didn't realize the dynamics of the vehicle because all cars are different, right? And the way you drive it, you have to really learn it. You know, even for me, jumping into an air-cooled Porsche, it's like not driving like any other car, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to really understand the dynamics. And sometimes these kids are like, oh, I got a 500 horsepower. Like, immediately from the dealer, they're like, hey, let's turn it to 700-800 horsepower. You know, you guys are out in, you know, the eastern side, New York, New Jersey. You see what's going on with the street racing culture there.
Yeah.
And you've heard recently about some of the guys who, you know, who've lost their life because of it. And those guys are experienced dudes, you know. So it's not just, it could happen to anybody, right? And there's a risk when you take your car out, whether it's on the track or on the street, something can happen. And it is very, very dangerous now. You know, even with all the safety, it is still a dangerous motorsport, right? You have to try to minimize that risk and try to be as safe as possible with the cage, the suit, Hans device, helmet. You know, don't skimp out on that safety stuff.
Safety is
right?
important.
Especially if you got families, you know, like you have to think about all this stuff now. You know, I used to do the half mile racing. I had 1,000 horsepower 991 Turbo S. And I did the half mile racing. I loved it. It was cool. You know, we were getting close to 200 miles an hour. And I just remember my wife was just like, that's it. Like, one more race. I'm like, all right, I'll do one more. And that's it. So I don't know if I'll even get back into the seat, you know, because, you know, like, and it's not just my family. I'm like, what happens to my business if something happens to me, you know? So I try to minimize the risk and all that stuff, you know, try to do better at taking care of myself on the health level. But yeah, it's wild what's happening with these cars these days.
Yeah, because I feel like you know, when we were all driving cars, we have good seat time, like years of seat time from the gradual power increases, where it's like now it's like, yo, instant. Yo, those kids just getting 500 horsepower cars from factory.
Yeah, I mean, like I've driven in some of my, you know, guys who do the twin turbo builds, you know, V10s. You get in there, it's like a roller coaster.
Oh,
you're
yeah,
like, I'm ready
wild.
To throw up. Like, these guys are like, you know, they hit the gas and like you never even felt that type of acceleration before, you know?
No,
I mean, it's
all.
Really getting wild. So, it's even happening on like the electric cars, you know? Some of these guys got these Teslas and, you know, the Plaid models, but like the tires aren't ready for those cars, you know? So, and the different weather conditions, I think people really underestimate when they go out to the street. You know, when people start street racing in the wintertime, it's a totally different ballgame with, like, you know, your tires
cold.
Aren't heated up. And, so it could be something that you have to really understand the dynamics of the vehicle that you drive, get the seat time, and understand the risk that goes into it as well.
Which platform would you say you know the best? BMW?
I would say Porsche and BMW. We know very well. The B58, S58 market is such a competitive market. Not just at the racer level, but at the manufacturing level, like everyone's cutting out for each other's throats. So we've really understood that car inside and out. We're always learning. We're always talking to the tuners. You know, we're getting so much data from the logs and understanding, you know, IATs and what's happening and like boost by gear and all the things that are affecting the cooling system and how we can improve our parts to make it better. And it's not just for drag racing, because there's guys who are doing track stuff, half mile stuff, you know, quarter mile stuff, you know, street stuff, canyon carving. I mean, there's so many different aspects of motorsports that those vehicles are being used. I really obviously got into air-cooled Porsche, right, because of building one and understanding more about that. So I took a real big, like, passion for the knowledge and understanding, like, more about that. But even the water-cooled Porsche stuff, you know.
But it's awesome to see, like you're saying, you're getting into air-cooled Porsches, which have been around forever, and you're still able to develop parts that are, you know, new parts at this time for such an old platform.
Yeah, I think, you know, the CSF Classic Series is what we call it, and we're really trying to like concentrate on like vintage European models, right? Because these are the cars I think are appreciating and people want to keep on the road, and they're looking for parts that no longer exist, right? I mean, a guy goes and builds a $50,000 air-cooled motor, but he's putting a cooler that's 40 years old, that's like junked up, and he's hopefully sent it out to get ultrasonically
cleaned
and it's going to work, right? Like, why wouldn't you just put a new part now that one exists, right? So we're trying to fill that void and really be able to give people something that looks period correct, but it's full of 2024 technology, the latest and greatest. I mean, we're selling those to like guys like Rossport, you know, every engine that leaves his place now has a CSF cooler on it. So yeah, it's been awesome.
So, going back to motorsports, a BMW platform, you have a lot of knowledge about different forms of racing. You mentioned the track, drag racing. What BMW platform would you say is the best in general for racing?
Depends on what type of racing you're talking about. I think from a drag race aspect, the new B58 and S58, you can't beat it. I mean, this is like the next GTR. These cars are going to be around for the next 10, 15 years of people racing.
Why do you say that?
Because it's like the best bang for your buck. You know, I mean, you can buy a $70,000, $80,000 M3 and you put 30 grand into it and you literally have a 7-second car.
Yeah.
You know, like that is really where the market's at, right? And you know, so I definitely think people are going to start putting those motors into other applications. I think you're going to start seeing a lot of like engine swaps once like people figure out like transmission swaps and all like some of those things. And the transmission is great on that car. The ZF8 that's an 8-speed automatic in there is like a, you know, there's guys beef those up. I mean, those are bulletproof transmissions. So I definitely think those will be around. I think if you're looking at other BMW motors like S54, that was in the E46 M3, people put those.
Still a strong motor.
It's a strong motor. It's great for the track. The E92 M3 motor, you know, that's V8. The V8. That's really good. So I've seen a lot of guys do V10 swaps on S60s, you know, like, so there's a lot of things that I think are great about BMW motors, and there's a great aftermarket support for it, right? There's a lot of guys building those motors. You can buy all the parts, you know, so I think those are awesome. So that's what I think about the BMW.
B58 or S58 in terms of drag racing?
I think the B58 motor is more developed because it's been around longer, but I definitely think the S58 is going to be where it's at. It's catching up, yeah. And it's newer. It's got some more advanced features to it. You know, now a lot of those cars, you know, have X drive, so it's four wheel drive. Like that M2 that we have in the booth, we converted that to X drive, so that's a four wheel drive because you got to put the power down, right?
Right.
So I think there's something there with like guys who have got M3s or, you know, maybe the new M2 is going to be X drive. They talk about a new Super Edition might be X drive.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that I think is a big advantage.
And then how about the Porsches? Let's go water cooled. What on track? What would you say is the best car?
The thing about the Porsches from the water cooled side, I'm a big turbo guy, right? So if you're doing drag racing or half mile racing, I mean, that's where you can get the biggest bang for your buck, right? So the 991 guys, I mean, you can buy a 991 turbo now for like close to 100K, and they're obviously more expensive to modify, maintain, and work on. But, you know, there's guys doing 1200, 1300 horsepower out of those cars now, you know, 1500 horsepower out of those cars. So I think 991 turbo is a good motor. 992 is getting better and better. You know, guys are already doing about 1,000 wheel out of those cars. So as the platforms develop, the latest, you know, era of those vehicles will always be good. But on the track, you can't beat a GT3. I was able to drive a GT4 RS at Porsche LA, like Porsche Experience Center over there, like a month or two ago. That's a great car. I think the Cayman's great. You know, it's a good mid-engine car, and it's, you know, it's agile, it's light, and, you know, you can put some extra power into it. I think from a street car performance-wise, the new 992 Carreras that are turbocharged is great bang for your buck. Yeah, because you can get
a little tune,
some bolt-on mods, and you have, like, turbo performance or better, but it's not a $250,000 car.
Right.
Right? You can get out of the door with all these mods for, like, $140,000, right? And it's a great-looking car.
Big difference.
So, yeah, so we see a lot of this in the market of what people are doing now that a lot more cars are coming turboed. You can really, you know.
Yeah, it opens up the door for tuning and
just
little upgrades that get the car going.
Yep.
You have the analytics. You've heard people complaining. You've solved the problems. What car has the worst cooling that you have a solution for?
The Honda Type R, the FK8. Had terrible cooling. Radiator was
too small, right?
Yeah, there was no radiator. It just wasn't good. And then guys would put a huge, you know, aftermarket intercooler in front of it. That makes the cooling even worse. We worked with HPD, like on an oil cooler solution. So they were adding those to all the, you know, TCR cars.
Oh, wow.
So from factory, you were getting a CSF cooling package in there. You were getting a radiator and you're getting an oil cooler kit that they were adding in the car. So that was a cool program to work on. You know, Nissan 370Z. Terrible cooling system in that car. It's actually a radiator and a condenser module in one.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know.
So, you know, it's like all stacked together. It's a pretty interesting way they made it, but I think it's over-engineered, to be honest. And I don't think they really gave it all the real-world testing. And then they definitely didn't take into account adding more power to the car, and it just doesn't have the headroom to support, you know, the tuning and, like, the aftermarket. So what we did is we actually separated it. We made it a separate radiator and a separate condenser, but we bolted it together.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to put a bigger radiator into the application and still make it fit without having to modify anything.
Nice.
So anyone looking to get an FK8 or a 370, just have an expectation you're going to need a CSF replacement soon.
Yeah. So that's what keeps us in business. We laugh. Right? It's like when we hear these guys and, oh, there's a problem. I'm like, great. At least we have something that we can sell.
Like, right.
Yes. Yeah. The things that you sell the most are not what people want. It's what people need.
Yeah, no.
That's really what we try to.
There's tons of those models on the road. So, you know, if you can't, if cars overheating, you can't drive it.
Yeah. And, you know, the sweet spot for us is not necessarily new cars, unless there's a problem. That's always great. But it's always cars that are like 7 to 15 years old, right? Because there's a replacement aspect.
Yeah.
Like if they're going to replace cars their original radiator because it's broken or it starts leaking or whatever, mm-hmm. might as well put a better one in there.
Absolutely.
Right? So, yeah, that's what's good for us.
So people have an idea of how big CSF is. I actually saw this picture on the website, like the facility, I think it's in Rancho Cucamonga.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah, yeah, it's a nice size warehouse.
Don't be modest.
It's a 75,000 square foot warehouse, and then we also have one in Virginia as well. So between those two warehouses, we keep over 150,000 parts in stock.
Big operation, and yeah. That's not even including the distributors that you're
exactly
going
so
to.
The supply chain, there's a lot of CSF on shelves, a lot of CSF in cars, CSF in our warehouse. So you know, we just try to keep investing back into the company. You know, it's not going anywhere. I got a son, maybe he'll be a fifth generation next. You know, so trying to just figure out different things that need cooling.
Yeah.
Hey, so we actually have a brand and some products that can help inspire your son to be a gearhead.
Yeah.
Called Fast Kids Club. We got Absolutely. These books that if you start reading to him now, there's a high chance that he's going to be very interested in cars growing up.
He loves cars. We have a couple of the books, and I think you gave them to me like a couple years ago when you knew I was having a kid.
So you're saying R should be for radiator.
Yeah. And I think I sent you a picture last year of, you know, my wife was reading him the book, and yeah, he loves cars. I've been FaceTiming him. He's like, Dad, show me another car. And he would just keep going on and on.
Oh, man,
on,
we so. Love hearing That's stories awesome. Like that.
Yeah. So it's nice to have him, you know, taking on to what, you know, I do. I take him to Cars and Coffee on the weekends, you know, and whenever he's around cars, just got him a little Power Wheels. And it's great because he always see me like detailing my car. Now when he gets out of his Power Wheels, he cleans his car.
Got to wipe it down.
That's awesome, man.
And it teaches him discipline, right? Mm-hmm. You can't cut corners. You got to do everything right. You know, I'm kind of stringent in that. And I try to like just be the best that I can be. And I'm trying to pass that, you know, ethos down to him as well.
Planting the seed.
Yeah, exactly.
Did your dad do that to you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think.
So your dad's a car guy at heart too?
You know, he actually had a 1981 911 SC that was silver.
Wow.
And I didn't really decide to make mine silver because of that. It just happened to be that way, that mm-hmm. that was just going to be the color that it, like, I thought was going to be the right color for the car. But it's just kind of, I guess it's, you know.
Full circle moment.
Yeah, full circle when yeah. he had that car. And, you know, I kind of grew up watching him drive that. And, you know, I was like, wow, that's an awesome car, you know.
Yeah.
And there I go building one.
I guess there's planting seeds, right? Your dad yeah. kind of put the pea seed in you early.
Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, I don't think many people know this. I know it because I've did a little deep dive on CSF. Company is originally founded in India.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we were a Dunlop tire dealer in the city of Bombay. And we then started repairing radiators. You know, that we kind of became like the go-to place in the city. Like, you know, everything was kind of copper brass back then. If you needed to get it repaired or fixed, we would do it.
In the 40s.
And then it kind of turned into like, okay, well, maybe we need to start making radiators because not every one of them can be repaired. And it kind of just grew from that. My great uncle, he's 87. He actually still runs that factory.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and actually all of our air-cooled Porsche product comes from that factory. So it was cool, like kind of designing and developing these parts with him, you know, different generations. And yeah, he's still there. He actually lives at the
what country is the factory
in? India.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, so we still have that. We still have a factory there. It's not going anywhere. I don't think anyone really retires in my company. You kind of just die. You know, you kind of just die working, I guess. You know what I'm saying? So
I mean, that's one thing to say, like, he lives in the factory. And,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, so, you know, my he was my grandfather's younger brother, and, you know, my grandfather's no longer with us, but, yeah, he was, like, everybody in my business, in our family, kind of, like, adds on and stacks something different, you know, what we do in the cooling world.
That's awesome.
That's impressive, I mean.
And then now, I know, you, since you obviously own the factories, you have manufacturing in India, and then where else?
So, we had a factory in Singapore.
Okay.
Like that we built in the 70s, and we no longer have it in Singapore. It's actually now being transferred to Jakarta, Indonesia.
Okay.
So that's where we make all of our aluminum radiators. And then we have a couple joint ventures in China that make like some of our intercooler product, AC condensers. We have a strategic partnership with PWR, who does all the stuff for like F1, NASCAR, mm-hmm. and they have a facility in Australia as well as here in Indianapolis. So a lot of our like super premium exotic billet parts are made in America. And we do a lot of added value, you know, either kitting, coating, all that stuff's done in California as well with the products. So
yeah. That's awesome.
Robbie, it's impressive.
Thank you.
Just hearing, knowing that you're an entrepreneur at heart, continually innovating, you know, I think it's a testament to show, like, just having something in business. You kind of had the silver spoon, but you didn't take the silver spoon because you started from scratch with this new endeavor. Of course, you had
a different vision.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I'm looking forward. You're super young. I see a whole lot more happening beyond your Ferrari project. Wish you the best.
Thank you.
And obviously, you're a friend of ours, so hope to continually see you elevate and get into the next level.
I really appreciate it, Brian. Hugo, you guys have become good friends of ours. I love what you guys are doing with the Fast Kids Club and the way it's inspiring the youth. It's awesome. I mean, I tell my wife every time I come back from PRI, I'm like, trying to buy stuff from you guys, take it home, and I'm like, man, this stuff is great.
I really appreciate that.
You know, I tell my friends' kids about it. I've bought books off the internet and sent them to some of my friends. You know, it's really cool what you guys are doing. So,
Thank you.
I appreciate you guys having me on the podcast and, you know, wanting to hear my story. And I hope the best for you guys as well.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
To everybody watching this episode, thanks for making it this far. And if you like this episode, please like, comment, subscribe. Till the next one, Eat, Sleep, Raise podcast. Oh, and we can't end it without asking for your socials if anyone wants to follow you.
Okay, cool. So, if you want to check us out online, it's Instagram. We got a lot of content on there. It's CSF_radiators. Check us out at CSFrace.com. And yeah,
you'll find how about us. You personally?
DJ Deluxe Ravi on Instagram. So if you want to follow me, I used to be a DJ.
I was going
to
say.
Yeah. So I did that. That's how I paid my bills in college, you know?
So you used to DJ in college?
Yeah, used to DJ in college, DJed after college. You know, I went to the University of Arizona.
School.
Yeah, you know, there's a little bit of that. So,
well, you did say earlier that you party a little too hard for us.
Yeah, but I would do like the 2,000, 3,000 people pool parties. So, you know, I've done nightclubs. So, yeah, that's a big passion of mine
as
well.
That's near
Havasu? It's in Tucson.
Okay.
Yeah, Tucson. So, so that's what I did for a long time. The Instagram handle is a little bit of a throwback to that.
That's cool.
Keep it.
Make sure you follow Ravi and CSF. Till the next episode.
Thanks, guys.